Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, Rational Security listeners. A quick note before we get started with this episode. We will once again be doing our year-end listener-submitted episode of the podcast in the week before New Year's. So if you have any topics you want to hear us discuss, any object lessons you want to share, be sure to email them to rationalsecurity@lawfareblog.com so we can include them in the episode. Thanks so much.
Scott, so a little birdie, which was you, 30 seconds ago, just told me that you have family heirloom tartan. And as you were describing that, Quinta came in and yelled, "Stop, save it for the B-roll." So here we are in the B-roll.
As we so often do in our little conversation before we get started. Indeed, I have an Anderson family tartan that my grandfather got on some trip to Scotland 50 years ago. I think it looks like this. I'm dropping a picture into our little chat window. It is not an attractive plaid, I will say. My grandfather had, I think, a kilt made out of it and like a scarf and a hat. And it is, I'm colorblind, so it's very hard to tell for me to tell what colors these are, but I know they don't look natural together.
It's like a yellow, so I don't know how to describe tartan. We have like some brown, light blue, yellow, red. I like it.
It's a lot of colors.
There's a lot
it's
going
maybe,
on.
It's maybe a little too much. There's an Anderson weathered option, which I really quite like.
That's the option I've opted for in my life. Why would I not opt that way?
It's just how you look ever since having a child. It's just Anderson weathered face.
Graying, ragged around the edges.
So this website will sell you a three-piece suit for $850 made entirely out of this fabric.
It looks like the suit some sort of like hobo would wear while riding the rails. Like, I feel like I need a bindle and a weird top hat with the top cut out of it, like a can. I think that's really what we're looking for here.
You can get a plaid flat cap for $72.
Well, hello. That's what I'm talking about. I feel like that is a big dad move, is when you start wearing Legend of Beggar Vance caps. I feel like you have to achieve a certain level of fatherhood to get there. I don't know if I'm quite there yet, but I'm close.
You can also buy plaid like pajamas for your kid. That'd be pretty fun.
You can get a wedding garter.
Hey.
You can get plaid hair brooches. You can get a little hat that has like a bow on it.
There are 23 pages of plaid swag.
This is delightful.
This is the most fun clothes shopping I've had since I went to the Renaissance Fair.
Oh my God. Guys, everyone shut up, because I just discovered the thing we have to all get, which is if you click on page 23, the Scottish plaid Highlander teddy bear.
Oh, well, that's just cute.
Oh my God. It has a kilt.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Rational Security 2.0. Well, now just Rational Security. We're dropping the 2.0. I am one of your co-hosts, Scott R. Anderson, and I am here back with my two other regular co-hosts, Alan Rosenstein.
Hello.
And Quinta Jurassic.
Hello.
And we are thrilled, as always, to be joined by one of our favorite repeat guests, Lawfare Executive Editor Natalie Norpit. Orpit, Natalie, thank you so much for being back with us here today.
Thanks for having me, guys. And do tell, what's the story behind dropping the 2.0? Is this an assertion of superiority?
I think it's an assertion of longevity. I also ran out of sequel titles a few months in. It turns out that it's really hard to come up with that many titles to turn into vague puns on Rational Security. And 52 in, I called it quits. And now, you know, we're just back to Rational Security. I think that's okay. We never changed the logo. We never changed the song. We're just, you know, just a continuation of a tradition.
I think we should actually go full totalitarian police state and change that, rewrite the history and just deny that there ever was. It always was. Who is this Ben Wittisk? He doesn't exist in the books
anymore. It's always been the three of us.
We were always at war with Oceania.
And we just have to like silently escort Ben out the back of a staff meeting, just like they did at the CCP Congress a few months ago. Yeah. The huge in town just walk as he looks confused and everybody else just looks dead straight ahead. This is the plan. Look out, Ben, when you come back in town, watch your back. Well, until then, though, we have had a big week here in the Lawfare offices with a lot of really interesting things happening in national security space. Actually, way more topics than we were able to get into this episode. But we picked three pretty interesting ones to walk through with you, the listener, for what we are calling the It Has a Kilt edition. For our first topic, topic one, surly intervention. Desperate circumstances in the island nation of Haiti have both Haitians and the international community seriously thinking about another international intervention, but no one seems excited about the prospect or eager to lead it. Where will these proposals lead? Topic two, what's the penalty for an equal substitution? Like a legal substitution, like the basketball penalty for people who watch sports.
Don't bring sports ball into
none
this.
None of you.
Stop
none of you.
Sports ball into this sacred space.
Scott, we've gone over
it's
this.
About an athlete.
I watch sports. I'm from Chicago, and I went to the University of Michigan. Okay. Obviously, I watched sports.
Scott's just desperately trying to martyr himself.
Exactly. I just want all the credibility I can get for my masculinity, because it's the only source I get it. Good the luck. Biden administration finally negotiated the freedom of WNBA star Brittany Griner this past week, but at a steep cost. The freedom of notorious Russian arms dealer Victor Boot. And Griner left behind her another American, Paul Whelan, who has been in Russian prison since 2018. Was the trade worth making? How should the United States handle these difficult hostage-taking cases? And topic three, justice delayed is justice in stride. Nearly 34 years after the Pan Am 103 bombing, the Justice Department has secured custody over Abu Aguila Massoud, a former Libyan intelligence operative believed to have built the bomb for and played a key role in that operation. Where are the proceedings likely to go towards justice from here? For our first topic, Alan, let me hand it over to you.
So we last talked about Haiti on this podcast in September. Since then, the situation has only gotten worse from an already really bad situation. Large parts of the country are completely controlled, though if you can call it control, by violent gangs. Severe energy shortages are crippling the economy. This is a country in which there really isn't an electricity grid. Everything runs on portable generators, which means that fuel imports are really important. And those have been disrupted. And cholera, which is, you know, a disease that really only at this point comes up in a situation of real social collapse, you know, where people just don't have access to basic safe drinking water, is ripping through the population. And you know, the main difference between the situation in September and now, in addition to the fact that it's just continuing to deteriorate, is that in October, the government, headed by Ariel Henry, who is the sort of acting prime minister and president, the government requested foreign armed intervention, which is obviously a dramatic step for any sovereign nation to take. It doesn't appear that this is a particularly popular option with the Haitian population. There have been some protests against it. At the same time, obviously, it's difficult for obvious reasons to get any good polling on a, you know, in a situation like this. But certainly this is not kind of a united desire on part of Haitians everywhere. And, you know, in terms of who would lead that armed intervention, the you know, most logical answer would be the United States, given the fact that it is Haiti's largest, big, stable, rich neighbor. And in fact, the United States has had a long, not always happy, to understate it, relationship with Haiti. And so far, the Biden administration has, while obviously talking about the problematic situation in Haiti, not been particularly, or it's not been signaling a particular desire to intervene. So that leads us, you know, in a difficult situation that's hard to predict. So let me start actually with you, Scott. What should the U.S.'s role be here, either, you know, leading this intervention or doing something more general behind the scenes?
In a lot of ways, that's really the hard question at the heart of this, at least for U.S. policymakers, but to some extent for the international community as well. The United States has historically played the central role in leading international intervention efforts in Haiti, certainly in the last few decades and really throughout the 20th century. In a lot of ways, they were highly, highly problematic. Of course, you had a period of about 20 years for the United States massively intervened in Haiti, engaged in a lot of pretty malign conduct, also kind of managed Haiti's finances for it in ways that were fairly exploitative in the early 20th century and kind of the World War I and beginning of early before World War II period. We've seen this kind of difficult relationship as the United States has with a lot of Caribbean and Western Hemisphere nations that is very close to colonialism, kind of a slightly unconventional colonialism compared to European colonialism, but still primarily colonial sort of experience throughout certainly the early parts into the middle of the 20th century. And then in the last few decades, we've seen the United States launch three separate interventions in Haiti. One in 1994 to restore a government that had been removed by a coup a few years earlier, one in 2004 to kind of put down a second coup, and that became a UN kind of stabilization mission. And then there was, of course, a US intervention to help support Haiti during and after the devastating earthquake in just about a decade ago. You know, that's a little bit of a different mission and hasn't proven quite as controversial, but actually brought with it certain problems, which is that these interventions, while they can deliver a lot of short-term goods in terms of stability and security, bring with them a lot of economic distortions. They bring them with them often a lot of cultural and social challenges. In the case of the UN mission, it brought with it a lot of very credible accounts of pretty widespread sexual violence and abuse committed by UN personnel. That is wildly problematic, but sadly not unique to Haiti among these UN missions. So it's got a very beleaguered history. And so I understand why the Biden administration is very reticent to take a leadership role here, even though it appears to be leaning towards favoring some sort of intervention, particularly with the calls from Haitians at this point. It is also happening at a moment where the Biden administration is both committed internationally in terms of Ukraine, has a very concrete foreign policy main objective and priority, that's Ukraine and China, or Russia and China, I should say, Ukraine being kind of the front of the Russian conflict. The Biden administration and Jake Sullivan and people kind of helped shape foreign policy there have been very expressed saying that they think U.S. foreign policy needs to focus on its top priorities and not get distracted by expensive side missions. And this seems like it could be an expensive side mission if the United States were to undertake it unilaterally. And so there are these domestic factors that certainly weigh in addition to the international intervention factor against potential intervention. But then on the flip side is not intervening, or at least the status quo, it comes with it many serious costs, real humanitarian costs for the Haitian people, and then much more practical self-interested costs for the United States, particularly in massive migration flows that have already started from Haiti and could get dramatically worse. And those flows have been major drivers of U.S. foreign policy responses in past instances, and I suspect pressure is going to build again here if they do continue to climb, as appears to be likely. So that's really the question, is how much can the reticence of the Biden administration be broken down? Because it's not clear who is going to step in to kind of spearhead this effort. The United States is really the only major power with a vested interest in this sort of scenario. It's the one that's most directly affected because of both historical and cultural ties to Haiti and the Haitian people, as well as the migration factor and the general security factor. The United States also plays a lead role in the destabilization in Haiti for a variety of historical reasons, and because, frankly, a lot of the guns that are being used in Haiti are coming from the United States, and the United States hasn't done a good job restricting those. All these factors combined just make it a really difficult situation. And I think it all suggests in a lot of other contexts, the United States should take a leading role in trying to address the scenario. The question is whether those pressures to take that leading role will at some point outweigh all the reservations, many of them quite reasonable, about pursuing a military intervention again in a country as complicated as Haiti.
It's a really helpful overview. I want to just follow up with you on one of the things you said, and I'm curious to get Natalie and Quinta your thoughts as well, which is this historical question. So there is no question, right? It is objective historical truth that the United States, along with many other nations, but let's talk about the United States for a moment, has dealt with Haiti appallingly, right? Ever since the beginning of Haiti, right? Which is, of course, the world's first and possibly only truly successful slave revolution. And because of that, it was a real, you know, ideological danger to countries in Europe and also the United States, of course, at the time, which had slavery. And so it was treated terribly. And so, you know, the path dependency, you know, persists today. And also given the last few decades of American intervention, again, a very problematic history. Isn't there a danger, though, of getting too caught up in that history? I mean, at the end of the day, the situation we're dealing with is right now this generation of Haitians, which is suffering, and there's a potential for this generation of Americans to help. And it does, I do wonder if the understandable desire of folks to bring up that history because it's an important reckoning, there's a danger there that prevents the ability to do good, right? I mean, I could imagine a counter argument which says, actually, no, the real value of the history in bringing this up is to point out the likely effects of any American intervention, especially if America doesn't change its strategy relative to what it did, you know, decades ago. But I assume that, you know, the strategy in 2022 would be designed based on what we know in 2022. And we don't have to be beholden to history as unjust, admittedly, right? No one's questioning that, as unjust as it is. I always get worried here. And I say this as someone who studied history in college and loved history and loves history and all of that stuff. I get a little worried when people say, oh, first we must begin with historical understanding. Because sure, but you can also get, you get boxed in by that in, I think, a very unhelpful way.
I don't know. I mean, I could imagine a situation in which we do get boxed in by history, but at least the commentary that I have seen around this has been more in the category of, as you say, Alan, using history to understand how these things can go wrong, right? In the same way that we were talking about the UN mission in Haiti and how that led to an epidemic of sexual violence, the introduction of cholera, many really, really negative effects that Haiti is still struggling from. In the same way, I don't think the takeaway from the U.S. involvement, for example, in the troubled rule and eventual departure of Jean-Michel Aristide, the president of Haiti, is necessarily a sign that, you know, we should, the U.S. should never do anything, but more that those calling for U.S. intervention should be very conscious about the ways in which interventions along those lines can be, you know, buffeted to perhaps ends that might not have been intended or pushed by you know, forces that don't have really have Haiti's best interests at heart. I do think that you can sort of meld all that together by saying, you know, that one way to think about this carefully and in a humane way is to say, how do we think about the people of Haiti as people rather than either a symbol of historical injustice or a sort of poor huddled masses with toward whom, you know, white Americans feel pity, but not a real sense of responsibility or empathy, but actually listen to them as people and say, what do they need? What do they want?
Not just white, to be clear, right? I mean,
right. But we are all white Americans talking about this. So that's why I was framing it in those terms. I mean, the other thing that I do think is important is that the U.S. conversation around this, as we sort of started with, is really, really focused on the immigration aspect. I was listening to a podcast on The Daily with a New York Times reporter on the situation in Haiti, and what she was saying is that the Biden administration's nightmare scenario, those words, was that this sort of collapse of the Haitian government would lead to a flood of migration from Haiti to the United States as people try to flee and go to safety. And I think that it is pretty telling that you know, the idea of people seeking asylum counts as a nightmare scenario for the Biden administration. We're currently talking, I think, the Title 42, which is the pandemic era measure under which the United States government has been turning back people at the border, is going to expire in just a few days, although the government is appealing a lower court injunction against its use of the authority. And I do wonder if that means that Haitians who are attempting to enter the U.S. and apply for asylum will maybe have a little bit more of an easier time getting into the country. But obviously that plays into some really ugly domestic political currents, and the fact that Title 42 has become such an important tool for the administration just points to how far right our politics have drifted. All of which is to say that it would be great, maybe, if the main thing that we could worry about is whether or not the sort of weight of historical injustice on Haiti was what was really driving U.S. decision-making here. But I worry it's more domestic right-wing politics on immigration.
Yeah, so before we go to Natalie, I just a quick follow-up on this immigration point. I agree with you that saying, oh, the real tragedy or the real nightmare scenario in Haiti is these people coming here, right? That doesn't sound great because it's not great. But American politics is what it is, for better or for worse, frankly, in this case. I do wonder, though, isn't there, maybe in a kind of a perverse but effective way, this issue of immigration, isn't that potentially the site for potential bipartisan cooperation on providing aid for Haiti, right? Like, look, I think we should have way more immigrants in this country. Lots of people disagree with me. Fine, whatever the case is, right? So go to those people and say, okay, you don't want immigrants coming across the border? Well, then we have to go and provide a lot of help to Haiti, whether it's financial help, military help, you know, aid of this sort or another. And I'm just curious, you know, do you think that the Republican Party is sufficiently, you know, internally coherent and can actually like do basic Weberian means ends rationality, right? To say, okay, we have this goal. We want less immigration. Therefore, we are going to do something to actually achieve that goal? Or do you think this is all just going to be a disaster?
I mean, it would be great if you were right. My concern is that, look, like we saw the same dynamic under the Trump administration. The Obama administration invested a lot of money in the Northern Triangle, this group of Central American countries, in an anti-corruption initiative to try to cut down on corruption, make those countries, you know, safer, more prosperous, to limit the factors that were pushing people to leave out of, you know, the need for food, out of safety concerns, et cetera. Trump came in, scrapped all of that work, like 10 years of work, and said, what we're going to do is we're going to try to fortify the border, and we're going to ask these Central American countries to try to fortify the border. And that didn't work. It didn't do anything. And so I worry that the, you know, on the right, the response is more to try to, you know, fortify the border and fortify immigration policy rather than to actually look at the cause of what is causing people to leave and think carefully about what the U.S. can do in that context. I would love to be wrong.
I do think it's worth bearing in mind here, this is where conflating Trump and the Republican Party, and particularly Republicans in Congress, can sometimes get you into a little tricky water. But remember, that Obama initiative did take place with Republican Congress. And
that's totally true.
To some degree, their support and certainly their appropriations, right? And there has been a fair amount of bipartisan coordination around a lot of, frankly, like regional foreign policy. Always points of tension and contention, Venezuela, Cuba being like the main ones. But there is, even in the some increasingly contested realm of foreign affairs, in the Western Hemisphere, it seems to be areas where there's more room for cooperation once you get away from those hot points. And I'm not sure Haiti is quite one of those hot points. But I think your point still will take in, Quinta. Just want to flag that.
I agree with this. I think I don't have a ton more to say on the immigration issue and the extent to which that is affecting the Biden administration's calculation about what to do. I mean, it obviously is, but I think hard for us to know, you know, what percentage of weight is the Biden administration giving to this vis-a-vis humanitarian intervention for other reasons? I'll just say, sort of circling back to Alan's initial point, I think that your question is fair, but also discounts the present role of history and rhetoric around history and how it's being deployed by different factions within Haiti. So the extent to which history is part of the discussion that is essential to figuring out Haiti's political future and has been being deployed, how these different framings of history and what interventions happened at what time and who they were supported by within Haiti, and how, you know, Aristide used certain gangs to try to promote his power, and you know, opponents did at other times, that this history is also very inseparable from domestic Haitian history. And the reason it's a self-perpetuating cycle, and it's also a chicken and an egg situation, frankly, because these interventions have been at not only U.S. interventions, but other countries as well, and in particular, UN interventions have been for a variety of reasons, some of them humanitarian and some of them really self-interested and terrible, as we've said. But they've also been responded to and utilized for the purposes of different entities, different individuals, different factions within Haiti to try to assert power and to leverage those interventions in different ways and shape their narrative of history and their arguments about why they should be in power accordingly. So I think that this is not a retrospective evaluation of history. I think it is, you know, it's not just a reckoning with what happened. It's more about how the existing actors are going to frame what should be Haiti's future and how that will be seen or not by the Haitian people as legitimate.
I think those are really well-taken points. And it's a lesson worth also bringing to our current context about how history is used also in framing U.S. or international response of different types. I think this question of international intervention often falls into this problem a little bit, right? We're in the scenario now that we are in kind of a pendulum swing after Afghanistan and Iraq, where we had a period where people were way too willing to engage in intervention. And we've been living through the consequences of that for two decades, where I think people are rightfully wary of intervention. But there's also a little bit to which I think we can let lose a little bit of ourselves in the history, or let the history cabin us in a way that kind of Alan was describing earlier on, boxing us in. In terms of ruling out certain options or framing them or tying them such a negative legacy in a way that groups things in binaries or cuts off options without actually engaging in pros and cons or detailed study saying, here's actually the things that might have worked or didn't work. I really think we're falling for that here. I mean, last time we talked about this, I said, and I stand by this, and I think it's proven true and it's going to prove true, is that we're just going to get to a point where we're going to be left with no better option but intervention. And I think we're getting there if we're not there yet. And I think we need to be honest about the cost and real risks of intervention and the hard parts that come with it. But we also have to acknowledge certain things that intervention might be able to accomplish. And the number one thing that's most kind of an immediate concern, it seems like, for the Haitian authorities and for people in places like Port-au-Prince and other places, is reestablishing core kind of basic foundational security. That is not a whole solution. I think in the U.S. history, we have this big problem that we tend to lump everything in as an intervention. And once we solve the immediate problem, particularly to ourselves, once we stop the immigration flows in this case, let's say, as kind of the most proximate threat to U.S. interests, all of a sudden, U.S. interest lapses, U.S. support fades, foreign assistance fades, it falls off the radar to some extent. And I don't know exactly how to combat that. And I don't think we should have any naive assumptions about how much intervention can accomplish. But it seems like there are little discrete goals where you could see making progress there. And in that case, if that's true, and I think it is true, and I think there's a good argument the United States is best equipped to do it. The United States has the most substantial military, most specific interests. Frankly, they have a military that has the best chain of command and discipline of regional militaries likely to do stuff like this. And frankly, of militaries that usually volunteer for UN missions, the United States is much better equipped. And on top of that, United States military also has a ton of military personnel used to dealing with civil affairs and domestic law enforcement because they occupied Iraq for a very long time and substantially Afghanistan. And those are actually like really substantial skill sets that are not easy to develop in a military force that a lot of militaries don't have, even though there are very flawed ways, things that obviously the military did in both of those countries. They've learned from those experiences, not perfectly, but they have developed new capacities. There's lots of reasons to be said the United States should be the leading actor in this. Maybe that's not going to sell domestically. Biden administration, I think, would be hesitant to do something like this without congressional support of some sort, something they could use to build a case for congressional support. I don't know if that's forthcoming, particularly in a now Republican-led House. But, you know, I worry the allergy we've all come up with intervention, a really real founded concerns, is leading us to a position where we're ruling actually tools that could be useful off the table, and the result's going to be much more pain felt by the Haitian people and to some extent the Americans as well.
Sorry, just really quickly, Scott, when you say congressional support, what do you mean? I mean, you know, like at the top end, there are A's UMF, all the way down to appropriations, all the way down to a sense of Congress being like, we're okay with it. So I'm just curious what you mean by congressional support.
No, I mean, I think most, frankly, legal scholars would say, not all, but some would say that a good number would say that if you're sending substantial number of U.S. ground troops, as this would presumably entail, you should get congressional authorization within 60 to 90 days. And otherwise, you risk violating the War Powers Resolution. And then you're in a position where you're supposed to be withdrawing if you don't get congressional consent. The executive branch has done its previous Haiti interventions without congressional authorization. They've also ended in under 60 days. In 2004, that's because UN troops moved in, and that's in part why UN troops moved in so quickly. So the Bush administration didn't hit that timeline, and it didn't become a big issue, although it was close, as I recall. I could be wrong, but I think it was close. So there's a real constraint there. Now, in other cases like Kosovo, you know, the Clinton administration basically argued, well, in that case, we had kind of tacit consent through appropriations. We think that's enough. And judicial review was kind of less likely to be available there. But in the current charged atmosphere, and because the Biden administration has a lot of reservations about the political kind of valence around doing something like this, I kind of suspect they're going to want something more than just tacit appropriations sign off by folks in Congress. I could be wrong. And as the crisis develops further, that need might lapse. But at this stage, it seems like they're going to want some political backstopping. And that just may be hard to get. It's not something Congress likes to give. And frankly, not something Congress has given really very frequently in recent decades, really since the AUMFs.
I'll just echo something I think we've alluded to, but I really want to remind people of, which, you know, Scott, you said a little earlier, there's a question here of whether we're losing ourselves. And of course, this is all wrapped up in broader questions about when, if ever, it is appropriate to intervene in foreign countries on a humanitarian basis, which of course there's always going to be debate on. There's always the question of if it is legitimate to do so, should it only be through, for example, the UN, UN peacekeeping troops or UN humanitarian interventions rather than individual countries. But I just want to sort of take it back to, and this is echoing something Quinta had said earlier, which is to, you know, we should keep in mind the actual Haitian people and what they might want. My sense of the reporting is that there was actually seemed to be some divisions about whether Haitians want foreign intervention or not. But I think we just need to come back to how absolutely desperate the situation is there right now. And not only for the purpose of deciding, you know, how scary might it be to people who are anti-immigration that Haitians will be leaving Haiti in droves, and, you know, how much that evokes what was happening in the 90s with, you know, people falling off of boats and with the United States having to detain Haitian immigrants in Haitian refugees, I should say, in Guantanamo Bay in tents, and all of these terrible images from only a couple of decades ago. What's happening on the ground there is horrifying. There are about 8,000 people, I think, who are just living in a square in Port-au-Prince, which is the capital. There are people who aren't able to leave their homes because they'll just be shot. So they can't get treatment for cholera, which is mostly affecting children. I mean, you read these stories and you just think the people who are living in Haiti right now are experiencing such mass trauma, and it's on top of so much mass trauma from, you know, the earthquake in 2010, the fact that there was a cholera outbreak around that in the aftermath that killed 10,000 people, the fact that there was so much political instability and violence in the 90s. I mean, it really seems never ending. And of course, again, to come back to the question of intervention, it's not going to be enough to, you can't go in and fix the humanitarian crisis, you can alleviate it. But of course, for the longer term, it will be necessary to figure out some sort of political solution and some sort of arrangement with a government that will be able to stand itself up, provide basic services so that these types of interventions are not required in the future. And there will need to be a legitimate and credible government. And of course, that is a much more complicated and long-lasting problem than solving the immediate humanitarian needs relating to, you know, fuel and water access and food.
Well, from one intractable situation with no clear or apparent solution to another intractable situation that appears to have reached a solution of sorts, good in some ways, but perhaps unsatisfying in others, let us go to the case of Brittany Griner, who is back at home, thankfully, after almost a year in detention in Russia, after the Biden administration struck a pretty notable deal, exchanging her for Viktor Boot, a Russian arms dealer, who has been in U.S. custody for 14 years, having served slightly more than half of a 25-year criminal sentence for material support for terrorism, conspiracy to kill Americans, and sort of other offenses relating to his international arms trafficking, specifically for a deal related to FARC, a designated foreign terrorist organization in Colombia back, you know, 15, 20 years ago. It's a big exchange, but one that has proven really controversial for two reasons. One, because people saying, how can we give up Viktor Boot, who seems, by some people's assessments, to be a bigger criminal than, I guess, Brittany Griner is somebody who needs to be brought home, that there's some sort of inequitable balance there in some folks' eyes. And two, the fact that she, being left behind in Russia, is one Paul Whelan, another American citizen, also a UK citizen and Canadian Irish, I think, a number of citizenships, who was arrested in 2018 and has similarly been held by Russia for several years on the basis of alleged espionage charges that the United States and other governments have said are largely, if not entirely, fabricated as a kind of political chip, which the Russians were not willing to throw into the deal for Griner, resulting in the one-for-one exchange. Quinta, let me start with you on this. What is your sense of the equities here? What do you make of some of the criticisms we're seeing of the Biden administration's choice? Do you think some of those criticisms are reasonable and well-founded, or maybe in good faith? Are they mostly kind of political slaps being made in an opportune moment for what obviously was a difficult decision for anyone in this position, including the Biden administration? And really, what does this tell us about kind of the broader notion and strategy of hostage diplomacy, which is just becoming a more regular reality, even than it has been for the last several decades in U.S. foreign policy, now with more and more with these peer countries like Russia and China?
Yeah, I'll hold off on the sort of strategic question of hostage diplomacy, because that I my thoughts are, wow, this seems like a tough issue. I'm glad other people are having to think it through. I will say on the response to Griner, I think at this point I'm a pretty embittered and pessimistic person, but apparently I am still capable of surprise, because I will say I was actually pretty shocked by the vitriol that was coming Griner's way after she was released and came back to the US. So if you've been lucky enough not to see this, there have been a lot of really ugly jokes on the right, particularly, of course, the Trumpist right, about the fact that Griner is a woman, that she is Black, that she is gay and married to a woman. There's a really nasty tweet from Donald Trump Jr. saying that, of course, the Biden administration freed Griner rather than Whelan because they were worried that their DEI score would go down. Just really stuff that I don't know. Like, should I have predicted this? Probably, right? Like, the human bile knows no bounds, apparently, as we've learned time and again. But I found it really shocking. You know, it recalls, I think, there's a New York Times story about this that references the case of Bo Bergdahl, the American soldier who walked off a base in Afghanistan, was captured by the Taliban, and who was eventually returned to the United States. And the deal to free Bergdahl was quite controversial under the Obama administration. I mean, her return kind of reminds me of that, except that, like, she didn't do anything. unlike Bergdahl, which was genuinely just like a weird case. I mean, Griner is her sin is that there was a trace of oil that had cannabis in it in some containers that she had in her bag, and Russia charged her with drug trafficking. She's clearly a pawn. And so I've been pretty shocked by the rhetoric around this. I think it's also worth noting that Whelan's family has been pretty out front. They released a very generous statement saying that they understood that, you know, that the Biden administration got a deal that they felt that they couldn't turn down, that Russia was treating Whelan's case differently. I don't know. I wonder if that's because Russia is insisting that he was engaged in espionage. And his sister gave a really interesting interview to The Atlantic. And part of what the family is expressing frustration over is the fact that Trump and his supporters are sort of running around saying, can you believe that Biden freed Griner but not Whelan? The family was begging Trump, according to these interviews, to do so much as tweet about Whelan during Trump's presidency when he was captured, and he didn't even bother. So, I mean, these are obviously people in extremely desperate situations, and I find it really disgusting and disappointing, if we're still capable of disappointment, that they're being tossed around in this way.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. I mean, I think framing this as some sort of DEI exercise is gross. Also, I mean, I will say, if you're going to frame it that way, at least recognize that it's terrible to be a hostage in the Russian prison system, no matter who you are. It's probably that much worse if you're a gay Black woman, given everything we know about Russia. You know, to me, the thing that is interesting, in addition to the depressing fact that the, you know, partisan culture war consumes everything, as Quinta pointed out, is that I just don't know how popular these hostage resolutions end up being. Putting aside the kind of the crazy fringe, right, that will always find a reason to distort this, just as a general matter, you know, I'm just not sure how much credit, as it were, Biden will get for this. Now, to be clear, that's not the most important consideration, obviously, but like it is a consideration and it is worth reflecting on. And I wonder if the reason or one of the reasons is that people recognize that getting a hostage back, even in the sense that it is a local victory, is kind of in some sense always a global defeat. If you do it in a way that does not end this tactics being perceived as profitable for the other side. And I just think there's just a recognition generally, and I'm not even sure the Biden administration would dispute this, that, you know, any victories here, well, I mean, obviously amazing for Brittany Griner and amazing for her family, and we should be so grateful for them. And, you know, if I were in their position, I'd be desperately trying to have this resolution as well. And I think this gets to Scott's kind of more strategic question. I just don't see how this does anything other than embolden whether it's Russia or China or Iran or North Korea or I don't know, whoever next to do this. You know, and I do wonder if the American public is beginning to recognize this fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as Quinta said, this is tied up with broader questions about hostage taking and what the appropriate response is, and both in the immediate term and in terms of negotiations after the fact. And it's just really complicated. And I think it's both a trend that needs to be thought about, but also a lot of times these are case-by-case bases and analyses. And, you know, one thing that I think is really lost in some of our domestic rhetoric, unfortunately, is the fact that the Biden administration has made clear that they could not have gotten Weyland out of this deal. And I believe that Weyland's family has acknowledged that and accepted that that is true. And so, sure, you know, bring up a debate about whether it was more appropriate to try to get Weyland for Victor Boot or Griner for Victor Boot. But it doesn't matter because he wasn't on offer. And the discussion there leaves out the Russian side of this, which is which person are they willing to let go? So the discussion with regard to Weyland is really sort of a red herring in my view, to say nothing of the fact that he's been accused of different types of crimes, and he was apparently not under discussion for this type of arrangement by the Trump administration, as you mentioned. But I think it's you have to look at what the realities on the ground are.
So I want to ask about this because I do understand that Weyland was quote unquote not on the table, but I guess I'm still not sure what that means exactly, right? I mean, everything is always on the table. The table is whatever the negotiators want the table to be. So I don't think you can say, look, we shouldn't consider Weyland here because he was not part of the negotiations. I think you have to say, no, we chose not to push Weyland because we were worried that we wouldn't get either. But I think that's a choice. Right? Again, I'm not criticizing the decision necessarily to say, look, we're going to get Griner and we'll deal with Weyland later. But at the same time, I mean, I do think, and maybe this can get into some of the strategic questions of you know, how can the U.S. be more effective in these hostage negotiations by bringing in other factors, right, in which it has more leverage than the other side does. But the idea that I think you have to just accept the other side's framing of, well, here's what's on the table. I mean, that's never true. And I do think that's an important point not to lose, even as we, again, correct the misinformation about the United States somehow like not caring about Weyland, which is obviously false.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair nuance to add to this. It is, of course, always true that negotiations of this sort require starting with a framing, and the framing is usually disputed. But I was speaking in the context of the domestic discussion of this. And I think sort of to your bigger point, it's just back to the same really intractable questions about how you set a policy about hostage taking and what the appropriate response is when, of course, it is a phenomenon that keeps happening and you have to worry about incentives and what messages you're sending and how this might affect other countries' calculations or the country that is doing the hostage taking now. But it is, again, like I said, also really case by case and really depends on the individual and the which other country is involved and what the person is accused of and et cetera, et cetera. What else is going on? For example, that Brittany Griner was arrested at the height of tensions between the U.S. and Russia on the eve of the Russian invasion into Ukraine, right? I mean, there are just a lot of factors specific to each individual case. And all of this is to echo Quinta's point that this is just really, really complicated. Okay, so I want to take the opportunity as a bit of a tangent, but to just give a shout out to what I thought was a really interesting article that we published in Lawfare a couple of months ago, which made the argument that Brittany Griner's, I was about to say kidnapping, Brittany Griner's arrest by Russian authorities is attributable to pay equity issues in the United States in the sports industry, and that we should think of pay equity in the United States as a national security issue in this sense, because Brittany Griner, who is one of the most highly paid athletes in the WNBA, makes $220,000 a year. LeBron James in the NBA makes $542,000 a game. So Brittany Griner, like many, many other WNBA professionals, works on the offseason, on the WNBA's offseason, in leagues in other countries. And many of these countries where women's basketball is very popular also happen to be authoritarian countries like Russia and China, where this sort of phenomenon is at risk. And so also taking into account the other social factors we were talking about and the symbolic factors of women athletes from the United States, and especially in Brittany Griner's case of a Black woman who's gay, who's an American athlete, you know, two-time gold medal winner in the Olympics, that this is actually an issue that has some roots that seem unrelated, but aren't in fact are. So I would just encourage folks to read that article from August. It was by Jason Blazakis in Lawfare.
So I want to come back to this exchange and kind of logic behind it, because I do think there's some interesting things here I just want to respond to that you guys raised. On the Paul Whelan bit on the exchange, right, the reporting we've seen is that the Russians floated trading Whelan not for Boot, but instead for another operative of theirs, Vadim Krasikov, who is an assassin who's being held in German prison for basically shooting a target of apparently a Russian assassination, a guy who was involved in Chechenian operations to some extent, kind of in the open in German park. And that this was seen as kind of a non-starter by the Biden administration for a variety of reasons, because including that this person wasn't in U.S. custody. What I do think it's an indicator, though, is that the Russians see Whelan as probably a bigger fish in terms of negotiating capacity for a variety of reasons, including that, frankly, Whelan is accused of, and because of his background as a security professional, as a military veteran, can be more credibly framed as a, frankly, like U.S. intelligence operative, even though the United States denies that that's the case. And I think there's every reason to believe that that's not actually the case. You can tie a lot of his activities and make them look a lot more nefarious in ways that might have more leverage in terms of who you're willing to push and trade them for. And the fact that he's been in prison longer makes him more valuable in a way, because it's that much more painful for the Biden administration to have him off the book. So I actually think, you know, the fact that Whelan is the one left behind is an underscore of that fact that he's actually a more valuable bargaining chip than Griner is. I think we think of Griner because she's a celebrity and because she has all these cultural nexuses, and our domestic politics as being a little higher priority. Certainly that's the way some people are framing it, to be critical of the Biden administration. I actually think it's the opposite in terms of geopolitics. At least that's what the way Russia is pricing this strongly suggests. The one thing I would say here in my mind is something we've come back to on this time and time again, is that I don't think we can criticize people for making these choices. I don't think we should leave Americans who are put in these horrible circumstances behind. And I think pursuing policies that get them released is a good plan and something we should and have to be doing, because we should not leave our nationals in the hands of hostile states to be mistreated by them. There's trade-offs, and obviously you can't trade away anything for that, but making a policy priority I don't think is unfair. That said, the United States needs to take seriously that this is a systemic problem and start cutting off the supply of people who are in these positions. And this is something I'm still surprised we don't see more of. Like, the sheer number and volume we have of things like people in the WNBA who are traveling to China and Russia to participate in tournaments, or for business travel, or for doing all sorts of other activities, who are at risk of exactly this sort of detention, I think is really highly problematic. And the United States needs to start seriously thinking about, well, how can we start really not just warning people, because they kind of already do that through travel warnings, but maybe deterring people from engaging those sorts of activities, certainly riskier activities than that might be involved, including, you know, potentially carrying medications that could get you in trouble, things like that. And then maybe deterring them from doing it altogether. And that's really hard to say for those of us who grew up in an era of a kind of a global, an open global economy, and where global travel was pretty available to almost any corner of the world. But, you know, I do think it's just as a policy priority, it's something that needs to happen, and it needs the Biden administration and its successor be well advised to start considering how to structure things in a way that makes these scenarios less likely to arise in the first place, as opposed to cutting off means of resolving them at the back end, as some people start to who criticize these exchanges are suggesting.
Well, the U.S. has lost custody of Victor Boot, but we now have custody of a suspect, a leading suspect in the 1988 Lockerbie bombing. So this was a long time ago. So just a brief recap. So this is in December 1988, flight Pan Am 103 exploded over Lockerbie, Scotland, killing everybody on board, and 11 residents of the town below were hit by various parts of the exploding plane. It was later determined that this had been caused by a bomb planted on board by Libyan nationals, likely linked to Libya's then leader, Muammar Gaddafi. Two were tried by a panel of Scottish judges who were convened in the Netherlands, but one, Abu Aghila Mohammed Massoud, was never taken into custody. In 2020, the Justice Department under Bill Barr indicted Massoud for his role in the bombing. The U.S. still did not have custody. He was in Libya. And now, quite suddenly, he appears to be in U.S. hands. It was announced earlier this week that he had been arrested. I believe as of yesterday or a couple of days ago, he was on U.S. soil in a U.S. courtroom. It's a pretty astonishing story. And I think there are a lot of interesting angles to it. I mean, as an initial matter, I think for the families of the victims, it's probably really important to sort of get closure for this event in their lives that had never really definitively been resolved. And I know I've seen victims writing and speaking about that. But there are a lot of questions, including, you know, how difficult is it going to be to bring this case against Massoud 34 years later? There are some strangenesses around the confession that he allegedly gave to a Libyan official in, I believe, 2012, after the fall of the Gaddafi government. And there's also some weird circumstances around his handover to the United States, which I am calling a handover rather than an extradition, because it seems like things might have gotten a little hinky, to use a technical legal term. Natalie, why don't I turn it over to you? Because I know you've been thinking about this and curating Lawfare coverage. What do you make of this development?
Yeah, I think, as you said, the things that are of particular interest to me are, you know, okay, so what happens next? And that has a lot to do, of course, with what happened to get Massoud into U.S. custody. And there are a lot of concerning things that are being reported about that. So as you said, the confession on which it seems the U.S. will be building its case, although of course we don't know because they haven't started making arguments in court yet, though of course we can read the indictment, was in 2012, soon after the fall of Gaddafi, who is someone for whom Massoud was working as an intelligence agent. So this was under, you know, new rule, recently deposed administration, for which the defendant who supposedly confessed made this statement. And he was then detained for a long time. He had been serving a 10-year sentence for other crimes unrelated to the Pan Am Flight 103 issue until about 6 months ago, and then was released. So there is a question to me of why was his release not negotiated with Libyan officials from Libyan prison? Because obviously, as you said, Quinta, the indictment was in 2020. So he was not extradited from Libyan custody, where he was already serving on unrelated charges, but rather released and picked up by a militia that is affiliated with the current prime minister, Dibibe, whose role is contested right now because he was part of an interim government for which his mandate ended about a year ago. And so to me, there are a lot of questions wrapped up in what all of this says about Libya and what's going on there. But of course, in with what is of concern to us, what does all of that mean? And how was Masoud treated in custody? How was he treated in his being picked up by this militia group and being transferred from the first militia group to another militia group to U.S. custody? What happened to him then that's going to affect his trial in the United States and the admissibility of any evidence that comes from there and just general due process concerns? I think there are just a lot of things to this.
Yeah, this is a really interesting case. And in some ways, it's kind of riding off a pattern that we've seen. We've actually seen a number of criminal suspects extradited, which I'll use in quotes a little bit because it's not clear. There's a conventional extradition in all cases. In some cases, rendered might be more appropriate. Out of Libya over the last few years, we had, I think, at least two criminal suspects related to the Benghazi killing, the attack that killed Ambassador Chris Stevens and several other Americans at a diplomatic facility in Benghazi in 2012 that have been found, brought back to the United States and prosecuted in federal courts. And this is kind of following that model. It's worth noting for folks who haven't followed this stuff, the United States has a legal doctrine around this, has for a very long time, that basically says no matter why this criminal suspect has found its way into your jurisdiction, they can be tried. Maybe they'll have legal claims against other people for unlawful conduct, but it doesn't affect jurisdiction over them. It's called the Kerr Frisbee Doctrine. And this is why for a long time, actually even more before 9/11, but even after 9/11 substantially, you would see terrorist suspects either kind of be lured to U.S. jurisdiction or sometimes in cooperation with foreign intelligence or law enforcement agencies, just kind of transported back. And so you will read in a criminal complaint the Justice Department prepares, usually in the Eastern District of Virginia or in New York court. In this case, it was in D.C. It looks like here in Washington, D.C. The complaint will say, the individual was thereafter found within the United States without much explanation about they arrived there, in part because it's not actually legally relevant, at least under existing precedent. A lot of people are highly critical of that. And maybe there are some limits that haven't been tested by the courts yet where that would give way, but that doesn't seem too likely here. Although I think all those issues about who transferred him here because of the state of Libya, all the different factors, very real policy questions, particularly in terms of the exchange and the fact that no one seems to be taking responsibility, very well might be suggesting that might reflect the fact that domestically politically controversial potentially, or that maybe it was a faction that's not the recognized government that the United States usually deals with that only controls part of the country there in effect. In regards to this particular case, I think this is a big victory. I think we should acknowledge that. It's important for the United States to keep chasing terrorism suspects even decades after the fact. Other than the fact we owe it to our victims, the Pan Am 103 bombing was the biggest attack in terms of fatalities to Americans until the 9/11 attacks. It is a major monumental event in American history that has been overshadowed a little bit by the 9/11 attacks, but nonetheless really weighed in the national psyche for a long time for good reasons. And it's important the United States keep pursuing that for justice for the victims and frankly to deter people engaging in this so that they know they're not going to be free from it really anytime in the rest of their natural lives. So I'm wholeheartedly support the Justice Department doing this, but we should not have no illusions. I think this is going to be a really hard trial. And I'm really curious what the Justice Department strategy is here. Alan, maybe you have some thoughts on this. I'll know for historical reasons that the actual trial that took place in the Netherlands under Scottish law before a tribunal of Scottish courts, this was the terms that Libya negotiated when they handed over the other prior two suspects for this attack, one of whom was acquitted ultimately in 2001. The other one was convicted and then subsequently released on humanitarian grounds once he was diagnosed with terminal cancer about 10 years later. That trial was really problematic because at that point they were trying people for an incident that had already at that point happened 12 years earlier. There was a lot of questions about witness credibility, in part because people had fuzzy memories and it was a high profile event and they were being a lot of the testimony and evidence boiled down to a specific bag and clothes bought at a specific bag that was loaded on an airport in Malta, transported to London, and then moved on to this flight that eventually detonated that a bomb was packed in. So they were asking things about storekeepers, about what they sold in a given day and how to interpret their receipts and bank records from 10 years earlier. Super complicated case to build with this big a passage of time. Now we're dealing with an additional 10 to 20 years on top of that, depending on what time period you're talking about. And the biggest thing that the FBI affidavit that supports the complaint, the like public record we have, hangs its hat on in terms of the evidence they have regarding this individual, is this 2012 confession they gave to a Libyan police officer and a suggestion that that police officer, at least in 2012, was willing to come to testify in the United States. Obviously, 10 years have passed since then. And I'm not even sure that would necessarily be admissible. I guess there are ways you could get in as a business record or as a, you know, a sort of other sort of evidence, but usually, you know, just that sort of blank confession without any other evidence, I think it'd be a loose thread to really hang a case on. Hopefully there's more than that they have, but Libby is a really hard environment in which to gather evidence. And a lot of other evidence has gone away. Maybe there's more forensic evidence that didn't come forward in the earlier trial, but we'll have to wait and see. I'm assuming DOJ has a plan here, and I suspect they'd be willing to take a big swing at this. I do think, regardless, I understand why they took the big swing on this. I think it's important that they did it. But I'm really curious to see how this goes, and I suspect they are facing big challenges down the road.
Scott, since you did name check me, I will say that my extensive trial experience, in which I spent an entire 6 months being really, really, really bad at my job in Maryland, leads me to conclude with high confidence that, yes, I'm sure DOJ has a plan.
I mean, I am curious about this because so the indictment was announced by Bill Barr in 2020. Obviously, Barr's Justice Department had a track record of sometimes, you know, popping off in weird ways. Is there any reason to wonder whether, you know, let's say they secure an indictment, Barr has this big press conference, new administration comes in, there's an opportunity to pick Massoud up, that the Biden administration's hand is kind of forced, or that the calculation is shaped by the fact that the previous administration secured an indictment, even if that's not necessarily something that this administration would have done? Or is that too like five-dimensional chess?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's an interesting question. And I think the timing of the initial indictment is also interesting. And I'm sure there is a lot of backstory here about which I'm unaware and maybe is non-public. I'm not sure. But, you know, one thing we didn't mention is that I think, at least in the popular consciousness, the identity of Massoud as being associated with this came from a 2015 documentary by Ken Dornstein, whose brother was killed on Pan Am Flight 103, and who did a documentary series deep dive research into what had happened and discovered Massoud in Libyan custody in 2015. So, of course, a documentary does not make for enough evidence to reach an indictment, but that was something that a lot of people have identified as being sort of crucial in tracking him down and affiliating him with this incident. Although, as I said, I'm sure there was a lot more going on behind the scenes that I'm not aware of. But, you know, I don't know why 2020 was the year of the indictment, and I don't know why the timing was what it was, as you asked, Quinta, but and also as I had referenced before, why the 6 months passed where after he had been freed from official Libyan custody was his transfer to U.S. custody then rather than while he was still in Libyan custody.
I'm entirely speculating. My suspicion, though, is that they pursued the complaint to try and do a formal extradition through one of the legal authorities in Libya, either the recognized government or maybe some other pseudo-governmental authority. And that did not work. And maybe they pursued some other avenue for acquiring custody over him after the fact, particularly after he was released. That's my suspicion at this point. And that could have been a lot of different things, whether working with a militia group, maybe special forces soldiers were sent in, as was done quite openly, as publicly reported in prior cases. So there's a variety of ways they could have accomplished custody over this. I don't think anything that the Trump administration could have done would have bound the Biden administration to pursue that step, Quinta, to answer your question.
No, to be clear, I just meant in terms of sort of changing the calculation.
I mean, you know, certainly like the fact that they obviously ID'd this guy and had eyes on him made it a tempting target. But I think as a matter of U.S. policy, really, there'd be a strong push, no matter what the administration is, to try and achieve custody and prosecute somebody like this because of the gravity and custody of these crimes. Just the real challenge you may face is that the United States has very real evidentiary bars for very good reasons in its criminal process. We have a strong, robust system of criminal defenses for a good reason. And you can often surmount those international jurisdiction cases. I think a lot of criticisms of that have been proven wrong in the fact that we routinely do prosecute, you know, foreign terrorism suspects in U.S. courts for crimes targeting Americans. but ones this old pose real challenges. And we've already seen those challenges in a very real way in Scottish court the last time around, and they've only have gotten worse in the last 20 years. So I do think it might be an uphill. One thing worth noting, this individual has also implicated himself in the same confession in the LaBelle discotheque bombing. This was an earlier attack that occurred in 1986, where he also claimed to have designed the bomb in the same manner as he did with Lockerbie. So it's quite possible that maybe there's additional evidence or additional charges that could be brought related to that incident. And I don't know enough about exactly what the evidentiary trail. I don't think anyone's ever been tried for that. There is a responsive military strike on Libya, as I recall, but that was kind of the full scope of the direct, you know, kind of public U.S. response that I can recall. No criminal prosecution. And at least two, maybe more U.S. service members were killed in that attack. I think it was two, with many more injured. So there could be charges brought from that. Also, the other thing I did notice in that complaint, they go spend a lot of time on this particular type of timing device that they have forensic evidence they think was used in the bomb. So it's possible maybe that they can tie this guy to that timing device if he's the person who designed it. But again, that's just a far cry, again, particularly for technology that, you know, the people who designed it and would be able to do that sort of fine identification haven't used it in 30 plus years because it would have predated the attack substantially. So again, we'll have to wait and see. It's going to be a really challenging prosecution, but I'm sure DOJ has a plan. I want to know what it is. I'm very curious.
Yeah, I just want to add one other quick point, which is to say, in addition to the evidentiary challenges that come from the passage of time and the environment that Libya is and was, there's also, as I alluded to before, the question of how he's been treated in custody. And if you're his defense attorneys in the United States, you know, one of the militias that was involved in handing him over to the U.S. has been pretty consistently accused of human rights violations, including torture. And that will most certainly come up if that is grounded in his defense in U.S. courts. So that's something to be taken very seriously.
Well, folks, we have to leave the conversation there because we are rapidly running out of time, but this would not be Rational Security if we did not leave you with some object lessons to ponder over in the week to come. Alan, what do you have for us? Why don't you get us started?
So I am delighted to announce that there is finally a good new Star Trek show. As loyal listeners will know, I am a huge Star Trek fan. I am Star Trek over Star Wars all the way, and I will engage anyone endlessly on the social medias about this issue. And I just have to say, I've been a little disappointed with the first of the two new Star Trek series, Star Trek Discovery and Star Trek Picard. I'm not a hater of those. I think they all have their strengths, but I think they have their real serious flaws. And I'm just delighted that the newest series, which actually came out in May, but I was so disappointed in the first two, I didn't even watch it until last week, Strange New Worlds, which tells the story of the Enterprise before Kirk takes over, when it is still under the command of the excellent Christopher Pike, is fabulous. And it is, I don't know, it's sort of what I think we were all hoping for when we learned there's going to be a new Star Trek series. It's fun. It's nicely updated, but it still has that Star Trek swagger. So run, don't walk to your nearest streaming-enabled television. Pay your whatever $9.99 for Paramount Plus, because what we all need is another streaming subscription, and watch Star Trek Strange New Worlds.
Quinta, what do you have for us today?
I have a piece of pop culture from a little farther back. I would like to recommend Don DeLillo's classic 1985 novel, White Noise, which I reread because none other than Noah Baumbach has a movie coming out. I guess it is in theaters now, though not on Netflix. A movie adaptation of White Noise, a book which I previously would have said would be, you know, completely unfilmable. And it looks kind of great. It has Adam Driver and Greta Gerwig in it. So I, inspired by this, went back to the novel itself, and I will say it really holds up. I mean, DeLillo is an incredible prose stylist. It's super readable and funny. There are certainly aspects that maybe hold up less well in 2022 than they did when they were written in 1985, but overall, it is, as the New York Times wrote in a profile of Baumbach around the movie, a surprisingly contemporary feeling novel. It's all about sort of living in an age of overstimulation and consumerism, and also unending dread And it feels very apropos for our current circumstances. So I would like to recommend that those of you who are inclined pick up the novel, and I will definitely be watching the movie when it is available on Netflix.
I thought the movie looks great. I'm really excited about it. There's a really, it was a really good profile of Bumbach, and I want to say it was a New Yorker.
That's the one I was thinking of. Yeah.
So it was really interesting. Yeah, I'm very excited about that movie. But for my object lessons, we are still in the month of December, and that means that I am doing holiday themed only. And so I'm bringing to you this time yet another holiday music suggestion to build on Soul Christmas, last year's perhaps my most notorious of all object lessons that I had in all the prior year. I still highly recommend that one. Earlier this year, I also recommended Lowe's Christmas album, which was also phenomenal. But I'm going to recommend this time an album that I find myself coming back to time and time again every year. A kind of famous one, but one that not everybody's aware of, called It's the New Possibility, John Fahey's guitar solo Christmas album. John Fahey, kind of a famous kind of avant-garde folk bluegrass steel blues guitar folk artist, basically rearranged and produced this really lovely, very innovative, interesting Christmas album. It's the perfect music for like listening to background while contemplating over a hot cup of warm something, staring out on a snowy, blizzardy day. That doesn't really happen here in Washington, D.C. around the holidays at all. Maybe a month or two later, every couple of years. But nonetheless, it's a great album to contemplate over. And it's like interesting enough to keep you interested and not be boring regular Christmas music. It's traditional enough to satisfy your family members like traditional stuff. Fahey did a bunch of Christmas albums. This is his earliest one. And there's also really cool liner notes that are worth finding, because he's a very big student of music, and they're very contemplative and reflective of both religion and philosophy and music, which really is in sharp contrast with his interviews of why he built this album, which he said he produced it because he saw Bing Crosby selling all those Christmas albums every year, and he wanted in on the action. But regardless, it's a phenomenal listen. I highly recommend it, and it's worth revisiting or visiting for the first time this holiday season. Natalie, bring us home. What do you have for us this object lesson session?
So I have recently been on a short story fiction kick. I, as will not be foreign to any of you fine people, I read a lot of news and listen to a lot of newsy podcasts and analytical things and foreign policy and law and read lots of legal opinions and blah, 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 blah. And it turns out that reading fiction written by just truly superb writers is delightful, especially when it has nothing to do with all of the other things that you have to read for work and life. So I will just mention two things I've been reading lately. One is, very surprisingly, I had not heard of this author before, though I wouldn't be surprised if I've read his stuff before in The New Yorker. I read a story in, I think, a November issue of The New Yorker called Princess by T. Corrigeson Boyle. I apologize if I mispronounced that name. But it was just so fantastically written, and I really, really enjoyed it. Short story, as I said, so easy to get through, especially if you're prone to falling asleep while you're reading at night because you have a three-year-old. The second thing I've been reading is a collection of short stories by Hilary Mantel that she wrote early in her career and had been off of my radar until I read a profile of her and her career after she died recently. It's called The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher, a collection of short stories. And it's also been really, really excellent and just sort of a nice way to engage with literature in bite-sized pieces and to have a little bit of escapism from the otherwise occasionally heavy things that I have to read the rest of the day.
Well, folks, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security 2.0 is, like its forebear, a production of Lawfare. Be sure to follow us on at RATL Security and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. While you are at it, visit lawfareblog.com for our show page with links to past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other phenomenal podcast series. And be sure to sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Kara Schillen of Go Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. We are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Patcha Howell. On behalf of my co-host, Quinten Allen, and our special guest, Natalie Orpit, I am Scott R. Anderson, and we will talk to you next week. Till then, goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.